We will go on the record and come to order. Good morning. The Commission is hereby convened in open session Thursday, November 30th, 2006, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor versus Jim Walter Resources Incorporated, docket number SE 2005-51. Present are myself, Chairman Duffy, Commissioner Jordan, and Commissioner Young. We will start with an overview of the case presented by James Clear of the Office of General Counsel. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Commissioners. This case involves three issues on appeal: whether substantial evidence, including inferences drawn from the record, support the judge's conclusion that the company violated 30 CFR 17.25C, which requires that when maintenance is done on equipment, that it be de-energized and blocked against motion. The second issue is whether he properly found that the violation was S&S, and the third issue is whether he properly imposed a penalty of $32,500. This case stems from a fatality at JWR's No. 7 mine in Brookwood, Alabama. At that mine, electrically powered conveyor belts transport coal from the face up to the surface at a preparation plant where rock is separated from coal. This is done through a series of belts. The North Main belt transports coal from the face over to the West A belt, and coal is dumped through a chute at the end of the north belt onto the west belt, and then it is moved further through the mine at Bide. On April 22, 2004, miner Gary Keaton was assigned to maintain the west A belt and the north main belt by removing any spillages that arose from the belts, and also to keep the chutes clean. The chutes were occasionally obstructed by rocks that plugged up the chutes and kept coal from flowing through. One way to remove rock was to use a steel bar and pry the rocks loose, thereby unobstructing the chute. At 10:35, Keaton was last seen hosing down a chute on the West A belt. Shortly thereafter, at 10:57 p.m., an unidentified individual was seen in a camera that took pictures from the area in which Keaton was work on the catwalk that overlooked the chute on the North Main belt. Also at 10:57, power was de-energized on both belts. On the West A belt, power was de-energized for approximately 32 seconds. On the North Main belt, power was de-energized for almost 30 minutes. At the beginning of the owl shift, Ned Martin, who was scheduled to replace Keaton, came into the area and could not find Keaton. He observed that the West A belt was running, however, the North Main belt was not. He also saw what he thought was a rock obstructing the chute from the North belt onto the West A belt. At around 4 o'clock in the morning the next day, Keaton's body was found in the refuse pile outside the preparation plant. Also on the surface inside the preparation plant, a steel bar similar to one that Keaton used was found. Following an investigation, MSHA issued a citation charging JWR with a violation of 30 CFR 1725, subparagraph C. Relying on 9 key factual findings, the judge drew certain inferences that led to his conclusion that a violation occurred. And I'd like to read from a portion of his decision that best encapsulates the inferences that he drew. Based on the existence of all these facts, I find that it is reasonable to infer that during the evening shift at about 10:57 p.m., a miner turned off electric power to the belts in question and then started to use a steel bar to remove a rock or rocks that were stuck in the North Main chute. Further, since Keaton was the only miner assigned to work in the area and his duties included clearing obstructions from the chute, it is reasonable to infer that Keaton was the miner performing this task during the time in question. I thus find that the factors relied upon by JWR are insufficient to rebut the inferences drawn from the Secretary's case in chief. And I end quote there. With regard to the S&S designation, the judge, relying on the criteria in Matthews Coal Company, concluded that the violation was S&S. And based on the penalty criteria in 110I, he assessed a penalty of $32,500. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Jim, and thank you for the DM. This is a perplexing case, and I thought you handled the evidence by both parties and that evidence accepted by the judge quite well in the DN. Are there any questions for you? Commissioner Young?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim, I'd like to echo the chairman's thanks and compliments on the insightful presentation of the case that you gave us, which really brought things into focus. It's difficult to try a circumstantial case. In this case, I think the parties definitely rose to the occasion. This case was well tried before the ALJ with witnesses who were well prepared, yet forthright, insightful and vigorous cross-examination, sound legal arguments, and each party appeared to have a very clear vision and theory of the case. I would affirm the ALJ on the finding of the violation because I think the basic facts support the finding, although I wouldn't necessarily reach the same conclusion as the ALJ on all of the sub-issues. However, I take, when he says all of these facts in the opinion, I take that as meaning, and I believe it's reasonable for us to take that to mean that no one fact was controlling in this case. Rather, he looked at this in the totality of the circumstances as would be proper and reached a conclusion. And once the ALJ makes it clear that that combination of factors was compelling to him, our role in evaluating that is fairly limited. And we just determine whether there's substantial evidence to support the judge's ultimate conclusion. The substantial evidence test is designed to ensure that these hearings are meaningful and that you give deference to the person who actually took in the evidence and heard all the facts and the witnesses and had a chance to evaluate their credibility. And for that reason, that test has been embedded in the Mine Act. Concerning the elements of the violation, I think the record establishes the legal basis for the violation as well as substantial evidentiary support for the judge's conclusion. As to whether Mr. Keaton was performing maintenance, the entirety of the record supports this conclusion. I do believe that there are reasonable doubts which were raised and evaluated and considered by the judge about whether he was clearing a rock chute or otherwise engaged in or preparing to engage in maintenance at a position where he would have been exposed to hazards from moving machinery that hadn't been depowered or blocked against motion. First of all, the record makes clear that maintenance was a primary job responsibility of Mr. Keaton, the miner who was unfortunately killed in this accident. It was also made clear through testimony that the chutes would become jammed on an irregular but frequent enough basis to make it a significant part of your responsibilities to keep the chutes clear, and that workers would sometimes stand on the belt, although there doesn't appear to be evidence of standing on a moving belt, to clear a jam. As to whether this is maintenance, I think the ALJ's analysis was correct, and I would also note that I think that the D.C. Circuit's decision in Ohio Valley Coal significantly lowers the burden for the Secretary. The Secretary doesn't have to establish that Mr. Keaton was actually clearing a rock jam, only that he was at least preparing to engage in or actually engaged in any maintenance activity that exposed him to the hazard of machinery that wasn't de-energized and blocked against motion. Mr. Keaton's job, I think, was clearly described by Mr. Martin, a miner who performed the same work on a subsequent shift. Typically, these miners work alone in that position, so there are not witnesses to what they actually do on a day-to-day basis. Sometimes the evidence seemed to indicate the possibility to be picked up on a video camera, and there was some evidence that Mr. Keaton, or at least somebody, and there's no inference that it could be anybody else, was shown standing on a catwalk, but it's hard to establish what anybody might have been doing or even what his or her particular work habits were. But you did have some testimony from Mr. Martin, which was not objected to, that he didn't see any other way this could have happened but that Mr. Keaton was on the belt and he was trying to clear a rock chute and the belt turned on for some reason. I don't think this is conclusive, but it is supportive and competent testimony. What we can tell from the circumstances and the testimony is that shutting down the belt for these miners is a big deal. Mr. Martin described it as, quote, my future, unquote. The miner doesn't do that on a whim, only if there's a problem, if something's wrong. And if something's wrong, and you go about fixing it. And what is fixing it? That's maintenance. Nobody else has been remotely connected to the scene, so it's necessary, I think, under the circumstances, to infer that Mr. Keaton was the one who used the switches to shut the belts off. Mr. Keaton, then, later, and a tool commonly used in a maintenance activity were both subsequently found on the surface, having exited the mine. And that tool, which was a 7-foot steel bar, was found in a location where it must have come out of the mine, and where it would be reasonable to infer it would have been noticed before too much time had passed, because it was stuck basically in the radial hopper there. There are other scenarios that you could construct that would be reasonable for what might happen to Mr. Keaton, but I don't think any of them renders the conclusion reached by the judge unreasonable. I'm a little bit concerned by the fact that the Secretary didn't investigate an alternative scenario posited by JWR, i.e. that Mr. Keaton fell off the crossover onto the west side of the belt and passed under the chute, which appeared to have been wiped clean by something when JWR inspected it. I would hope that accident investigations are conducted to determine what happened, not just to plot a field to establish a violation of the hearing. But the ALJ had the opportunity, regardless of whether this was considered properly or investigated by the Secretary or not, to review that scenario and the evidence supporting it, and it wasn't unreasonable for him to reject that. As to whether the belt was powered off and blocked against motion, regardless of any deference due to the Secretary's interpretation, the determination that the standard requires the power to be turned off at the source and tagged out, I think is obviously correct. I think that's the best and most certain way to ensure the machinery does not become re-energized while a miner is working in a vulnerable position. And in the case of a belt, it might have been the only practical method to ensure that it was de facto blocked against motion. When you have a miner working on a situation like that, any number of factors, distraction or noise, or even unconsciousness could have prevented Mr. Keaton, for example, from hearing Mr. Martin when he was calling out to find out where Mr. Keaton was. But if the machinery had been tagged out, I don't think they would have done anything before they found the person who tagged the machinery out. I don't know that that contributed in any way to Mr. Keaton's fatality, but it's not required for the Secretary to show that the failure to tag it out contributed to the fatality. Simply that it exposed the miner to a discrete safety hazard, which created a reasonable possibility of a reasonably serious injury. And for that reason, I would affirm the judge on finding the violation and also on the SMS, and I believe that he correctly set forth the penalty criteria and applied them, and I would affirm that as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. Commissioner Jordan?
Thank you. I'd also like to thank Jim Clear for his memo that was helpful and his assistance in analyzing parts of the record. I would agree with my colleague, Commissioner Young. I believe he's actually set forth the appropriate analysis here and focused on the pertinent facts. The case here is one based on largely uncontroverted facts, and the decision really boils down to what conclusions does one draw from those facts. Nobody was there as an eyewitness to see what happened at the time that Mr. Keaton fell into the conveyor belt. But there were facts that were set forth in the record, and the judge considered those facts. And although one might draw alternative conclusions from the facts, our job, the point is that the trier of fact can choose between reasonable inferences. And it's not required that the inference the judge draws be more likely to be correct or is the most plausible conclusion to be drawn. And I do believe that the inferences that the judge drew here, that Mr. Keaton was engaged in maintenance work with a belt that had not been de-energized and blocked from motion, and therefore that there was a violation of the standard that occurred. Whether there are other possibilities, that would lead to the conclusion that Mr. Keaton was not engaged in maintenance. Jim Walters has put forth a possible scenario that they believe would fit the facts of this case, but each of those scenarios that have been put forth, there are certain facts that are given more weight for certain facts that don't fit in. And in the end, I find that the conclusion that the judge drew is a reasonable inference from the facts. That, and I think many of those pertinent facts have been outlined by my colleague. The fact that somebody, Mr. Keaton was the one assigned to that area, somebody turned the belts off, it's reasonable to conclude that he's the one that turned the belts off. Belts being turned off, it's reasonable to conclude that there was a need to address some problem with the belt, to deal with some maintenance issue. The observation of somebody's boots on the catwalk, testimony to the effect that a person would be going on the catwalk for the purpose of performing maintenance. The discovery of the steel rod outside along with the body adds further support to the inferences that the judge drew. So in the end, I am not able to conclude that the judge's inferences were unreasonable in light of the facts that were set forth in this record. And I would also agree with my colleague that the violation charged here is one that is S&S, and that the evidence supports that holding as well. And I also agree that the judge's analysis of the penalty is reasonable, and I would affirm the judge in that regard as well.
Thank you, Commissioner Jordan. If I were the fact finder in this case, I would probably not find for the secretary. The basic scenario presented by the secretary and accepted by the judge, in my view, has been substantially called into question by JWR. For example, Mr. Martin, the first on the scene, testified that there was no spillage along the North Main Belt, thus undermining the secretary's contention that the chute was clogged. Likewise, I believe it is much more plausible that Mr. Keaton cut off power to both belts from the west side of the North Main Belt, utilizing remote switches B1 and R4, and that is supported by Mr. Martin's testimony as well. In short, I don't believe the evidence necessarily indicates that the chute was clogged, but if there was some sort of temporary hang-up in the chute, it could have been freed by Keaton's quick shutdown and startup of the West A Bell. Consequently, I don't believe the evidence supports the Secretary's contention that Mr. Keaton climbed onto or straddled a moving bell to free up the clog. Under Commission precedent, however, my reading of the evidence is irrelevant so long as the inferences drawn from the evidence by the judge are plausible. In my view, the judge's decision is based on four essential findings. One, Mr. Keaton's duties included freeing up clogged chutes. Two, Mr. Keaton was the only person working in the cited area. Three, the West Main Belt was running during the operative time. And four, the drill steel was found on the surface at about the same time as Mr. Keaton's body was discovered. Former President Clinton used to talk about inferences and circumstantial evidence and said that when he was young, his stepfather used to say that if you find a turtle on top of a fence post, you can be sure of one thing. It didn't get there by itself. And the drill steel, for me, is sort of the key piece of evidence in those four conclusions that the judge made. While the rest of the judge's conclusions in some respects shore up the essential findings, I believe these four findings were crucial to his determination that Section 75, 1725C was violated. Accordingly, under the substantial evidence rule, the judge's decision must be upheld because it is basically reasonable, even if, in my view, the inferences he drew from the evidence are less likely correct than other inferences that I or others might draw. With respect to the S&S issue and the penalty issues, I agree with my colleagues and would affirm the judge in those respects. There's nothing else. Again, thank you very much, Jim, for the DM and the assistance to us in reaching these conclusions. If there's nothing else, we are adjourned.